Daniel chapter 1, and we'll begin in verse 1 and read through verse 5 to get our time started today. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar and to the house of his God and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate, and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. So again, here is a nice introduction to the story. It's setting the scene for us of what's going on. Like any good story, you have a beginning, which is going to identify the characters, going to identify the setting and what's going on. And what's really important about this is in these first five verses, notice everything that the king is doing. Right? If you look at all of these verses, the king comes and he besieges Jerusalem. Verse 2, the king conquers Jehoiakim. Also in verse 2, the king takes the vessels from the temple. He takes the vessels that were placed in the temple of the Lord and he takes them back to Babylon. Verse 3, the king commands the captive to be trained and indoctrinated under the Babylonian culture and language. And then in verse 5, the king even assigns the food which these captives are going to eat. So as we're reading through these, you keep seeing the king, the king, the king, the king, and all these things he's doing, right? And again, it gives the appearance that he's in control, that he's running the show. And what's even more significant to this is that in verse 2, did you catch this? It says, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. What's that referring to, the house of God? The temple, right? Where God dwelt. And that is, of course, unique to the Israelites in the sense that that is actually where the God dwelt. But all the other nations, or I should say most of the other ancient nations, they had temples too with their quote-unquote gods in it, right? And what's significant here is that if we keep reading, it says, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, that's Nebuchadnezzar, to the house of his God. Notice the similar language there. I'm taking your God stuff and I'm putting it in the house of my God. What do you think that that indicates to the other nations that are watching? Yeah, we beat your God. Look, we're taking his stuff, right? We have victory over your God. And what's really significant is that little word, land of what? Shinar. Anybody know where that first appears in the Bible? Babel. Right, Tower of Babel, the first rebellion of mankind on a corporate level coming together against God, right? If you're with us with Revelation, Shinar becomes the place of rebellion against God that Isaiah picks up on, that Zechariah picks up on, and then that John concludes in the book of Revelation. It is the system of evil that originates, right? The word Shinar is only used 8 times in the Old Testament. So it's very significant that Daniel would choose this. If you read Jeremiah, when Nebuchadnezzar actually conquers Jerusalem, it says, and he takes the people back to Babylon, right? But Daniel says Shinar. Now, think with me. Why would he use that term, knowing that it's connected to the first rebellion against God? What's the point here? Oh, I thought you were raising your hand. Okay. And notice that God's temple items, the holy items, are taken to a place that's known for evil, right? So it looks like who is winning? Evil, right? See, this is setting us up, again, not just for the book, but for the chapter. You see, and remember in Nahum 1:14, we saw this a couple weeks ago. Remember when God said, from the house of your gods, I will cut off the carved images and the metal image. See, this idea of the house of the gods is who has victory, who is winning, right? Who's in control? So plundering an enemy's temple indicated the power of your God over their God. And Daniel uses a term that makes it look like evil is winning against God. Not just Babylon, but evil, right? Because here's God's temple being plundered by a pagan king, right? And it looks like evil is taken over. So this is very important. Daniel 1 appears as if God has lost from a merely worldly perspective, yet will reveal how God truly remains sovereign over every circumstance. Now listen, this is so important. How many times do you and I look at what's going on in our world and it appears like evil is winning and is going to win and there's no stopping it, right? You see, Daniel is giving us the perspective of the Jews in his day, right? That's where God dwelt. And a pagan king just ransacked God's house and put it in his pagan temple's house. It looks like evil is in control right now and running the show. You see that? And again, we can relate directly to Daniel. How many times do we see evil? Not just some evil politician or something like that. I'm talking evil. And we see it and we're like, wow, it looks like it's taking over and there's no stopping it. You see, Daniel prepares us for what we experience even in our own lives. This is what it looks like sometimes. But he's going to show us, don't worry, God's still in control. God's still in control. So the conquering of God's king, Jehoiakim, the plundering of God's temple, the captivity and indoctrination of God's people, it all looks like evil's taken over and there's no stopping it, right? So let's look at verses 3-5 once again, and let's actually look at the king's instruction. What is Nebuchadnezzar actually going to do with these Israelites? Again, in verse 3, it says, "Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans." So just very quickly, we'll go over a couple of points here. So notice that the king wants people from the royal family and nobility. So in other words, he wants people that are important, people that are significant, right? He's looking for individuals that that represent something, right? Individuals that people can look up to. And this is why when a king would deport or exile individuals from the royal family or nobility, what they were trying to do is indoctrinate them in their culture for years. And at times, they would actually send those leaders back to their land, hoping now we're going to be friends, right? We've forced our culture on you. You've lived with us. You've been under us. And after a couple of years, hopefully tensions will resolve. We send you back to your land. And now, you know, we're kind of buddies, right? So they want the people that are influential. That's the word that I was looking for before. And then notice that he wanted youth. Why do you think he wants youth? And just to be clear, we don't know the exact age, but all the commentators collectively say between the ages of like 14, 15 to maybe 20, 21, somewhere in that range, right? So why would he want youth? Indoctrination. Okay, what do you mean by that as it pertains to youth? Okay, it's easier to do that to a child, right? Does that sound familiar, right? When we talk about things that are going on in our society with schools and stuff like that, yeah, I mean, this has been going on for thousands of years. They know if you get them young, they're easily influenced, right? It's amazing the things you find in the Bible that pertain to what we're seeing in our day. So it's not only because a youth is someone that's easier to sort of bypass, right? But also because if you get them young, you have them for a longer period of time, right? You start them young and you have them for an extended, right? If I indoctrinate a 60-year-old, maybe I'll get 15, 20 years out of them, right? Instead of a child, which is like 40, 50, 60 years, right? So that's the idea. And that is true, by the way. How long was Daniel's ministry? 69, 70 years, right? So it worked, right? Because he remained in power even when the Persian king came in. So for 70 years. So you can see why they chose that. And then notice what the king wants. He wants them to be, and this is kind of funny, I have them segregated here, without blemish and of good appearance, right? Without blemish means no injury, right? So he doesn't walk funny or he broke this bone or he's missing a finger, right? He wants him to be someone who's not handicapped. We can use that word. And then good appearance in Hebrew literally means desirable to look at, right? So no dorks, nobody who's not handsome, right? It literally means desirable. So it's somebody who looks good, somebody who's attractive to look at. They don't want somebody ugly, right? This is in the king's court. So he wants the most pristine looking people, right? He wants them to be handsome. He wants them to be good looking because they're going to be in his court. So notice those first two things have to do with the outward appearance. And then in the red, skillful in wisdom, all wisdom rather, endowed with knowledge and understanding and learning. This describes just the intellect. These kids need to be sharp. They need to be smart. They need to be able to learn, to process and take in information. They're going to be working in my court, so I need them to be able to learn. They have to learn our language. They have to learn our culture. They have to learn our deities and our gods and our religion. I mean, there's a lot that they had to learn, and they had to do it in 3 years. Right? So he needed the sharp kids, okay? The very smart ones. And that's what he was looking for, intellect. And then that word, and competent to stand in the king's palace, the word competent means physically and intellectually stable, right? So it combines all of those things together. It is a well-rounded individual, good-looking, sharp, can learn, and can do things well, right? That's what he's looking for. I don't know how accurate this is. I read it from one source, and they said they believe that about 50 to 75 Israelites were taken when Nebuchadnezzar first came in 605. And because no other Israelites are mentioned, they say out of that pool, they only found these four men, right? So they kind of whittled that down. But very high standards that the king had. And then the last part here is, what does he want to do with them? To teach them literature and language of the Chaldeans. Now, what does that actually mean? Is it just, I want to teach you our language and how to read some of our books? No. If we study what these kings did and what the purpose of this was, we have a comment here from Tremper Longman. He says, quote, the goal or desired outcome of the literature and language teaching was reorientation of the exiled individual in their thoughts, beliefs, and practices. See that? That's what the king was after. He wants to change how you think, what you believe, and what you practice, okay? Another commentator, Lucas, says, quote, the learning process intended for these Judean exiles was thus one of induction into the thought world and culture of Babylon. We want you to think like us, act like us, even eat like us, right? We want you to become what we are, okay? Now that's the problem. If we just read that God's stuff was taken to the land of Shinar, because the implication is we want God's people to become like the pagan world, right? And now you're beginning to see why it is so significant in verse 8 when Daniel resolves that he will not eat of the king's food, right? What is he really resolving to? Not giving in to the pagan practices that go against God's word. And here's what's fascinating. I could preach for an hour on this, right? Daniel actually does some of the things. He learns the language, he learns the culture, he gets wisdom, right? He's able to do what the king needs him to do, right? They accept him into the court. But there are things that he will not do, which is, I won't eat food that will defile me. You see, this helps answer the question that so many Christians ask today. What does it mean for me to obey the government if the government I believe to be evil, right? Daniel shows us. It doesn't mean you say, I reject you and I will not listen to anything you say. No, Daniel says, no, there are some things, yes, that you do. As a matter of fact, we'll jump real quick. Look at verse, where is it? Verse 12. This is Daniel speaking to the authority over him. He says, test your what? Wow. Look at that. He calls himself a servant of the Babylonians. But at the same time, he's also a servant of who? God. You see that? God doesn't call us, because we're servants of him, to just totally reject human authority if it's not a Christian or something like that, right? We have to use wisdom to know, how do I honor the governing authorities, but at the same time, not go against the Lord? And Daniel shows us that perfect balance, right? So regardless of how you look at it, he's caught in a situation where they're trying to change him. They're trying to change his friends. They want him to believe in their gods, follow their culture, their standards, their diets, their rules. And the big problem with that is the purpose, I'm going to test your knowledge here, we just came out of the Torah, the purpose of God's law and the instruction, other than to worship him, was to do what? If the Israelites follow those laws, what does that make them look like? There you go. They're different. If Daniel and his friends eat, think, behave, and believe all the things the Babylonians do, what happens to the people of God? They cease to be different. They cease to be a light, and that's put out. You see that? So Daniel's stance here is literally saying, I will not blow out my candle, right? I'll do the things that I can do. I'll learn the language. I'll study and all that kind of stuff. But there's a line here, right? So that's what's going on here. The king, as part of the indoctrination process in verses 6 through 7, changes their names. Daniel, his name means God is my judge. That's going to be very significant when we get to chapter 7. I'm not going to tell you yet why. And then his name is changed to Belshazzar, which means may Bel protect. Hananiah, which means Yahweh is gracious. His name is changed to command of Aku. Mishael, who is like God, is changed to Meshach, which is who is like Aku. And there's Azariah, Yahweh is my help. His name was changed to Abednego, which means servant of Nebu. Do you notice something that's common between all the names that have been changed? What's common with all of them? There's a name of a pagan god in it. Okay, you see that? And if you look at their names, the white, what's common with all those? Right, just God's name in there. So what they're doing is they're trying to strip them away from their God and push them. And you can even see with Mishael, it sort of echoes, right? Who is like El, who is like God, and then who is like Aku. They're trying to mimic that, but they're indoctrinating them into the false religion, right? So that is the king's command, all right? So we see what he is after, what he's trying to do. And again, hopefully we understand a little better now what we're about to read. Let's look at verses 8 through 14. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he that you were in, so why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. So here's what's going on here. Daniel resolves, and that word in the Hebrew means to stand firm, to plant yourself. You will not be pushed over. You have determined, I will become a pillar and I will not move from this position. He has conviction, and that conviction is grounded in the word of God. He knows what Yahweh has commanded him, and he knows the balance of what he can and cannot do. You can change my name. You can teach me your language. You can teach me your mathematics and your agriculture. You can teach me your systems. But when it comes to what Yahweh has specifically required of me, I cannot breach this point here, right? Now, that is very bold. And if Daniel says that, and again, let's take it that he's like, we'll go in the middle. Let's say he's 16, right? Because they say anywhere from 14 to 21. Let's say he's 16 years old. What is a 16-year-old's word against a ruler who just conquered his people, right? At least a portion of them, and brought them to his land? Who is this little boy to tell this guy who's in charge, who has a direct command from the king to feed them a portion of the king's table? What's this little squirt going to do to change this guy's mind? Who are you, little boy? The king has commanded me to do this, right? So we really got to like understand what's going on here, right? It's this little teenager whose people were just defeated, and now the king has commanded, and he's saying, well, I don't want to do that, right? So this is where we really begin to see God come into the picture again, right? That's why verse 9 is so important. And God gave Daniel favor. Because when we understand what's going on, a 16-year-old boy or even younger talking to this man who just defeated his people, he has no say in the matter. They could have killed him and his friends for rebelling. They could have said no, right? But instead, God comes into this circumstance and says, I'm going to take control. And God is doing this as a direct, He's directly working as a direct response to Daniel's faithfulness. Daniel's honoring the Lord, and God is responding by honoring Daniel here. You see that? And God has the ability to control the circumstances. Because when we understand what's going on here, you're like, well, there's no way Daniel's getting away with this. But then God comes in and says, yes, he is, because I'm in control here. So look there again at verse 9. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. Let's just add a little bit more difficulty to this. This guy who's in charge of them says, by the way, Daniel, if I listen to you and it doesn't work out, my head comes off. If I take the advice of a 16-year-old and it doesn't work, my life is in danger. Why on earth would I put my life at risk for your silly request? Just eat the king's food. Right? Like, that's how we think it would go. What person in their right mind would listen to a young boy and his request when your life is on the line? I'd say, no, thank you. I don't even know who you are. And yet, because of verse 9, this is going in a way that we wouldn't have expected it to go, right? So what we see here is in verses 1 through 7, God is sovereign over the kingdoms as he gives the Jehoiakim to the king of and to the king of Nebuchadnezzar. But then here in this second story, in verses 8 through 16, we see that God is also God is also sovereign over our circumstances. We will come into situations in our life where we will be like, there's no way this can go any other way than the bad way, right? And God comes in verse 9 and says, watch this, right? Look at verse 12. Test your servants. Notice the respect and the honor that Daniel shows to these pagan leaders. For 10 days, let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. You know what's interesting about that? If this guy really wanted to help Daniel out, he should have come up with that idea. He's the adult. Okay, we could try it for like a week. But after that, no, it's the little guy that comes up with the plan. That's a good plan. All right, let's just do it for 10 days. King gave us 3 years. What's 10 days in 3 years? If it doesn't work, then we'll do it your way. Notice the wisdom of God's servant. You see that? This is very important to see. Verse 13, then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them. That's amazing. So he listened to them. This little boy with so much wisdom, and he is orchestrating how this is going to go. The Babylonians are supposed to be saying, here's how it's going to go, boys. And it's the little boy who's saying, no, here's how it's going to go, right? But he does it, again, not specifically like that. He's very honorable, and God is with him. And it is the Jew in captivity who is actually determining the course of events. You see that? This is flopped because God is in control. You see that? It's amazing. Verse 15, at the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables, right? I'm not even going to address what are the vegetables. There's so many different views out there. We don't really know. It was something other than the king's food, some vegetables. Some think it was porridge because the Hebrew word refers to seeds that maybe were ground up or something like that. But the point is, there was something about the king's food that would defile them, whether it was going against God's law or something like that. Daniel knew what would honor the Lord, and he was resolved to do that. And the point of the story there is God has the power over your circumstances. And if he chooses to honor you, he will. If he chooses to protect you, like we're going to see in chapter 3, he can protect you. He is sovereign over all these circumstances. Let's close with verses 17 through 20, the last section here. Oh, I'm sorry. Real quick, if you look up Genesis 39, verses 1 through 5. I'm not going to read all of it. But remember Joseph, when he went to Egypt with Potiphar, the Lord was with Joseph. His master saw that the Lord was with him, and the Lord caused all that he did to succeed. At the bottom there, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house, and the Lord was on all that he had, right? Same thing with Joseph. He's put in a situation, pagan land, under the Egyptians, and yet the Lord, the Lord, the Lord, the Lord, the Lord. God was with him, and he prospered because of the power of God in a circumstance where he was just a slave ripped away from his family. He shouldn't have been in any type of power or had any type of favor, right? So we see that this is the consistent character of God. All right, let's look at verses 17 through 20. And for these four youths, God gave. There's the third use of the phrase in the story. Verse 2, and the Lord gave, verse 9, and God gave, verse 17, and God gave. This is the main point of the story. It's at the beginning, the middle, and the end. God is in control. God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And at the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke with them. And among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king. Now watch this. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and encounters that were in all his kingdom. Real quick, go back to verse 5. I'm sorry, verse 4. He wanted them to find youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all what? Wisdom, endowed with what? Knowledge and understanding. Go back to verse 20. And every matter of what? Wisdom and what? Understanding. You see that? That's what the king wanted, and the king was going to do it the way he wanted to do it. And when these four Jewish boys appear before the king, they are 10 times smarter in the matters of wisdom and knowledge, or wisdom and understanding, which is exactly what the king wanted of them, but it's 10 times better. Why? Because of verse 17, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. You see that? God did it his way, and his way is better than the king's way. See, that's what Daniel is showing us here. He is showing us that all the while, it looks like, from a worldly perspective, Nebuchadnezzar's in control. that he's commanding all these things, he's orchestrating all these things. But Daniel says, but if you take a step back, God's actually the one that's in control. Shh, don't tell the king, right? God's orchestrating the events through this little teenage boy. God is actually giving the wisdom, not Nebuchadnezzar through his silly little classes. It's God. And when God does it, it's 10 times better than when man does it. You see, everything is demonstrating God is beating Nebuchadnezzar at his own game. Everything Nebuchadnezzar is trying to do, God's doing it better. See, that's the point. You took over Jerusalem, that's because I gave it to you. It's because I'm the one with strength who allowed you to do that. You took over these little boys, you're trying to indoctrinate them? Well, I'm actually going to use them to tell you what to do. You want to give them wisdom and understanding? I'm actually going to give it to them, and it's going to be better than any of the guys that you trained. See, every aspect, God says, I'm on top, I'm on top, I'm on top. It looks like you're on top, but I'm the one who's in control, and I'm orchestrating all these events. See that? It's awesome. It's unbelievable. So verses 17 through 20, I mean, it is believable, but it's amazing. God is sovereign over individuals. Those are the three things we see in this chapter. Three times. The Lord gave, God gave twice. God is sovereign over kingdoms, circumstances, and individuals. And notice that that's like a narrowing effect, right? From the broad spectrum of things to the larger or to the smaller circumstances to the individual. Right? God giving an individual wisdom, an individual intellect. God's in control of everything from the big to the individual and everything in between. And on that last point, this is kind of like the punchline of chapter one, is remember when we said, don't forget these kings here, right? This is the rise of the Babylonians. We're in control, right? And you have all these kings here during Daniel's time. And look at the last verse of Daniel chapter 1. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. You know what that tells us? Even the kings with all of their power, God's man Daniel outlived and outshined them all. They couldn't even survive the length of their empire, but Daniel did. Isn't that amazing? You have five kings who die, and God's captive in their land outlives all the kings. Not only does he outlive them, he outshines them. We're going to get into the very next chapter. Next time we're together, Nebuchadnezzar can't figure out his dream, right? He calls all his guys. They can't figure out the dream. But he calls the captive from Yahweh, and what does he do? Oh, I could tell you the dream. Right? He outshines the king. He outshines the men. He outshines the enchanters. He outshines the magicians. He outshines everybody. Chapter one is showing us God is in absolute control over kingdoms, circumstances, and individuals. When from a worldly perspective, you say, I don't know how God's going to do this, don't lose faith. Read Daniel and say, God can do this. I just have to wait to see how he will. My job is to be like Daniel. How am I going to serve the Lord and be faithful to him as he works out his plan for his glory? So that's sort of like the last punchline at the end there. And it says, oh, and by the way, he reigned to King Cyrus, which was a Persian king, which means he outlived all the Babylonian kings, right? So it's just really, really cool to see there. All right, application for tonight. And I apologize if I spoke fast. I knew we had to get through the whole chapter and I want to save time for prayer. Application for tonight, three questions. Are we resolved to stand firm in Yahweh when and if the authorities tell us to disobey God? Right? Are we convicted? Have we established within our hearts as we see the times shifting? Are we going to be ready to stand for the Lord? I don't know if you guys saw that article over in the UK just recently. A man was arrested for a post that he put on social media, right? So they're now arresting people for social media posts and stuff that they can disagree with and things like that. Are we willing and ready to stand on the word of God if it means that we can be thrown into prison for it? Do we know, second question, how to honor God and the authorities he's placed in our lives? Daniel did. Daniel knew exactly what to do. He knew how to speak in a way that showed honor and reverence but he also knew the balance of where to say, this is where the line is, right? And he wasn't disrespectful. He knew how to honor God and the authorities. That's a question we need to ask ourselves. Do we know how to live as Christians in America with the tides shifting, possibly drastically shifting in the next couple of months, depending on what happens with our election? Are we going to know how to honor the Lord and those whom he's placed over our lives so that we can shine for his glory? And then the third question, long. Do we live like God is in control over the kingdoms of the world, the circumstances we face, and the individuals in our lives, to include ourselves? That's the three things we see in this chapter. Do we live with that confidence in the Lord? When somebody asks you about the global setting, do you say, yeah, I know God's got it under control? Circumstances in your life, trials and the persecution, the suffering, are you able to see through that God's still in control? Your own individual life, where you think you lack, where you think you struggle, where you think you need to be built up or strengthened. Are you trusting that is the Lord who will give you that, to give you the love you need, the grace you need, the strength you need, the endurance you need, right? That's what God gave to Daniel. That's what he will give to us when we call upon him. See, so every aspect of this reminds us that God is in control, and he's not just working on a global scale, he's working on an individual scale for his children, his people. Such an encouraging open to the book of Daniel. Do we have any questions or comments as we close our time together before we go to prayer?